Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everybody, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's terrific to have your company for another episode of the show. Now, for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, you'll remember Eagle Boys pizzas. I remember as a student engaging in competitions of eating as much Eagle Boys pizza as I can and so on. And my guest today is the founder of Eagle Boys, Tom Potter. And in this conversation, we're going to talk about how Eagle Boys came to be the business phenomenon that it was, the things that Tom learned about starting up, the things he learned about scaling up, and ultimately the things he learned about exiting as well. In this conversation, Tom's really generous. He shares, you know, how he did what he did. He talks about the different systems. He talks about how he got the concept store going. He talks about some of the challenges he had along the way and some of the lessons that he learned, which are directly applicable to dentistry. And so if you want to grow and scale your practice, this is a podcast that you really, really want to listen to. There's so many lessons in here about leadership and management and structure and strategy that I know that if you have a pen and paper handy, you're going to be writing furiously to grab all these pearls of wisdom that Tom shares. So without any further ado, here's Tom Potter, the founder of Eagle Boys Pizza, coming to you on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Tom, thanks so much for joining us here at the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Wonderful to have your company, mate.
My pleasure.
Mate, your story is well known, the founder of Eagle Boys. It's a much-loved business success story around Australia, and as a Queenslander, I think I've probably ate my body weight several times over in Eagle Boys pizza. Yeah, it was all good fun, but I'm really interested to unpack the lessons that you've learned as a result of that venture and obviously things since then. But before we get into that, I'm curious to ask a bit about the background, how Eagle Boys came to be in the beginning. What prompted you to start the business?
Oh, look, I worked in the flour milling and bakery industry, and I had a certain level of skill in the technical aspect of what goes on in bakeries. And a lot of people don't understand that if you can work with the equipment and work with the environment and work with the formulas and the products, you'll know what you're doing. And it was in that period that I was approached by a guy who had this vision of setting up these home delivery pizza businesses in a factory system. Mm-hmm. So I sort of worked with him for a while, but that didn't really work. But when I saw it, I thought I realized I could micro that whole concept into a store-by-store concept. Because one of the things I'd said to him is, this can be done on a micro basis. You could set up a high-volume pizza shop, you know, in every store. And he sort of looked at me like I was an idiot. And I said, no, you could systemize this. Anyway, he didn't, but that's where I went and birthed Eagle Boys, because for me it was like, this can be done, and we went and did it. And we were lucky enough to do it in regional Australia, because that's where I grew up and came from. So I went back to my roots, and regional Australia was almost virgin territory. No one was doing home-delivered pizza. So there's nothing better than a monopoly to get you started.
100%. Now, that was in Albury, right? Is that's home for you?
Yeah, Albury, yeah.
Mate, nice part of the world. Yeah, what was that first store like? What did you, getting the first prototype store going, what did you have to figure out in that process?
A lot of it was making sure that I had the systems in place.
Yeah.
And that was immediate, because I did have a very clear picture that we were going to have substantial volume in the business. Mm. Probably the number one thing that I focused on when we opened was marketing. If anything, it was probably too much marketing. We got slammed and smashed. And there were a lot of lessons out of it, but one of the lessons that I'll carry to this day is that in a lot of cases, if you sell, say, 20 different products, customers will only want about 8.
Mm.
So, you know, I really like to dumb down businesses. I mean, we've got a donut business now, a company called Galactic Donuts, and we sell a range of about 30 donuts made fresh every day, thousands and thousands of donuts in some of the stores every day. But I reckon if we cut the range back by half, it would make no difference. I mean, the good news is that we don't have to, but we've just put a tender in for one of the big airports in Australia, and if we go in there, I think we'll probably only sell about 10 donuts, but we'll sell lots of them.
So it's a really interesting concept of this restricted menu kind of offering that you just spoke about. For better or worse, I like watching Gordon Ramsay on his go into a restaurant and fix it up kind of show. And quite oftentimes, he's simplifying the menu, saying just, you know, dumb down the menu to use your language. So when you started Eagle Boys, how many pizzas did you say you had?
We sold about 12.
12?
But we sold them on three different sizes and two different bases.
Right, so the combinations and permutations thereof.
In fact, it was three different bases because we sold a multigrain pizza. We sold that for years and years and years. And in fact, until the idiots who bought out the business, the venture capitalist, I think we still had it on the menu.
Yep.
But if you have a range of 12 pizzas, that sounds easy. But then you go, oh, three bases and three sizes. Problems.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about that concept because the whole idea of restricted menus is something I've really actually enjoyed thinking about for a while. There's a couple of practices around the country actually engaging in a restricted menu type of dental practice, and they only, you know, offer certain procedures and that's it. And it's quite unique. It's like a specialty practice, but with general dentists running it. It's quite an interesting model. I'm curious to ask, coming back to the donuts, if you've got 30, you know, possible styles of donut, but only half a dozen or a dozen of them sell, what's the value in the other ones being on the menu? There's got to be a reason for them to be there.
Well, I wouldn't say that that's the case. I'd say that a dozen of them are the biggest sellers. They're probably 60-70% of the range. But I'd probably come over the top on the comment where we have a coffee shop. It's actually not a coffee shop. It's a dungy little coffee cart that's opposite one of our businesses, which is a bakery in Brisbane. And even though we sell really good coffee, nearly 4,000 customers a week out of that bakery, people still insist on going to that hole-in-the-wall coffee for their coffee. And quite often we've gone and compared them and gone, geez, I think our coffee's not only better, but it's faster. But people see something that says, this is what we do and we do it well, and that's what they accept. You brought up Brookie before because she's got this sensational following on social media with her cookies in Brisbane. She really only sells one product. That's what she's famous for. And I think that there's a great lesson in being, well, what are you famous for? What are you really good at? What are people going to trust you to do? And I think that there's a great lesson in that.
Yeah, amazing. So tell me, going back to the Eagle Boy story, yeah, you've got the first store, it's up and running, you've got your systems going. How did you decide when was the right time to open subsequent locations? What were the trigger points for that?
Oh, I think the picture in my mind was that I've got 8 hours in the day.
Yep.
And in that 8 hours, can I run one shop or three? And the answer was I can easily run more than three. If I start divesting my time properly and have three times the outcome, if run properly, of course. And, of course, when I went and opened up three, initially that was the case, and then eventually it was problematic because our business in particular needed more of a hands-on approach. When you're serving thousands and thousands of meals to people every day in regional towns, you need people in there that actually care what they're doing, otherwise you'll have food poisoning and all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
So ultimately we flipped out of owning them ourselves and we flipped them into franchising. You know, you could call it licensing, franchising, or part ownership, but that seemed to be the answer for us. But I think the biggest single problem was geographics. You know, when you start talking about driving between Albury and Dubbo, you know, you got 4 or 5 hour drives in each direction on country roads. So that was more of a, hey, if we're going to open up stores all over regional Australia, we can't own them.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting thought about the franchising model versus the direct ownership model, and you articulated the reasons why. What makes a good franchisee?
I reckon the bigger question is what makes a good franchisor, because there's...
What? That's my next question.
Yeah, there's a shitload of bad ones in Australia, I'll say that much. What makes a good franchisee? Some of the best franchisees that I've met for companies like McDonald's, and some of these guys are NRL superstars and played football for Australia and so forth. These are guys that are really independent, tough, rugged blokes that you'd reckon would be that kind of personality. But they got into McDonald's and they went, it's been made very clear to us that if we want to buck the system, we buck the system in a way that is appropriate to everybody. We don't start pushing the envelope in the wrong direction. And they've been very successful. Car dealers are the same. You know, car dealers, these guys that go in there and buy up certain brands, they're very clearly and closely monitored by the parent company for very good reasons, and that is the other car dealership down the road doesn't want to have their name tainted by their bad operations. A good franchisee knows where he stands and works with the team. That's the good way to look at it. There is no one particular type of personality.
Okay. Then to the follow-up question, which is what makes a good franchisor, as you said, there's a lot of rubbish ones around. So what do you think set you guys up for success?
We put the franchisee's profit before everything else, sometimes at the cost of our own detriment. And if you were to ask me what's a bad franchisor, I'd say assholes that are too greedy and have lost sight of what matters the most. My chairman, John Kozik, who was a brilliant operator in this industry and had long history, he was literally the creator of Sizzler, would say, look, there is a very important and balanced triangle here. It is customer, it is franchisee, and it is franchisor, and they have to be balanced. The customer has to win out of every transaction he does with us, so does the franchisee and so does the franchisor. If that gets out of balance, everybody's going to lose. And I would cite Domino's as a company right now where the profitability of the franchisees is completely inappropriate to the outlay they have to spend and the amount of effort they have to put in.
So in terms of other successful franchisors around the country at the moment, who do you identify as running a pretty good shop? I mean, you're in this space, you know the players, you know, which, you know, I don't want to get into rubbishing people, but who do you think is doing a good job?
My brother bought a franchise from Zimbrero.
Oh, yeah.
2 years back. He sort of called on me and said, who do you think's worth looking at? I said, there's probably two emerging industries. And this is the industry we understand, which is food and drink. And I said, there's two emerging industries. There's drive-through coffee and there's Mexican. And we looked at them all and we ended up coming up with Zimbrero and we chose a site in Perth. Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, the Zimbrero parent company had offered them, my brother, at least half a dozen sites, none of which we thought were appropriate. Mm. And ultimately, my brother said that a lot of those that did open didn't do as well as they expected. But the one that he and I chose, which was in a precinct surrounded by McDonald's and Pizza Hut and Baskin-Robbins and everything else, was a highly successful business for him. So I think there is, all I can comment on is in the industry that I know, which is the food and drink, you know, there is a lot of work that has to go into making sure that not only retail food groups are a classic example of how not to do things. And they're continuing to not do things. And the place is run by an accountant and all they do is nothing. They're really good at doing nothing. So, you know, that represents over 1,000 small businesses in Australia that are achieving nothing.
It breaks my heart that I have shares in Retail Food Group. Actually, Tom, I can tell you that. I've watched them kind of go to nothing almost and think, oh, maybe they'll come good, but I think it's time to sell those suckers.
I went to their annual general meeting last year and I think they were terrified that I was going to turn up and jump up and down. And the chairman grabbed me as I walked in the door and he introduced himself and then he said to me, oh, you know, probably you're the only shareholder here. And I said, what a tragedy. Anyway, I sat there and listened to them go through the process and then everybody got up and walked out. I think they served everybody a handful of stale cakes at the back. That was about it.
So just to shift gear for a second, mate, because I'm really interested in the Eagle Boy story and I'm curious to ask how you set up your head office, what sort of team structures you had in place, how did you liaise and manage relationships with your franchisees? And again, how did you ensure consistency across the board? Because, you know, I think one of the things that franchises are famous for is that degree of consistency. I know you're going to talk about systems, but making sure people don't go outside they don't start painting outside the lines. How did you get that all sorted from a team point of view and consistency point of view?
Look, there's only one way to smash a watermelon and it's with a sledgehammer.
Yep.
And there's nothing better for morale than a public hanging. And in a lot of cases, you'd have these idiots in these certain regions that all get their heads together. Like, you know, have you ever seen that scene out of Monty Python when they say, what have the Romans done for us?
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yes.
And, you know, you'd have to make it very, very clear to them, this is the system that you're bought into. If you consistently want to change it, get out and come and speak to us if you want to do something different. So that was a difficult management over the years that continued to get better as we went by. I will say something about systems that we made a big mistake on. we overcomplicated the systems early, and you know, we would write manuals that were magnificent. I mean, they're still magnificent to this day that no one ever read.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I reckon if you can put an operations manual for a business together in about 5 to 8 pages, that'll do you.
Yep.
Because a year later, half of it won't be relevant and the other half will have to be updated. We don't have an operations manual for our Galactic Donuts business.
Okay.
And some of these stores turn over pretty big volumes, very big volumes. What we do is we say there's about 4 areas of focus here, so let's just focus on those and then double back if we need to do any more. But I would say don't overcomplicate the systems. Keep it very, very simple and highlight or prioritize what matters.
You know, one of the experiences we've seen is very similar to what you've just described. People have got a beautiful manual. It's a lever arch folder full of documents of this, that, and the other that doesn't ever get looked at. And it's almost like writing a piece of fiction in the sense that, you know, this is what we aspire to and this is what we say we do, but what we actually do is totally different. So, you know, you kind of wonder what's the point. And I really like that. I really like that idea of just keeping it simple and focusing on the core things and keeping the main thing the main things. Interestingly enough, Tom, our whole business here at Savvy runs on 6 numbers and only 6 numbers. And if the activities that we do is not moving one of those numbers, I ask why we're doing it. Coming back to the Eagle Boy story and what you've been able to do, we spoke a little bit offline about a customer that you know, a bakery that you know, and holding on to things too tightly, the owner kind of holding on to things too tightly. And I see this regularly in dentistry as well. I wanted to just talk for a moment about what you called the owner's trap. I wonder if you can just spend a moment articulating that.
So I've got 2 or 3 mates that have got bakeries all around Australia. A couple of them are actually quite famous in their names. And in the small amount of time that they've allowed me to actually go in there and have a look at their operations and actually dig into their books, it's almost embarrassing to see how bad the profits are in these businesses, or minimal they are. They're stuck in the past. They don't want to change. They can't imagine change. They don't trust themselves with change. And everything they've done has got them to where they are, which isn't necessarily as good. And I'm talking about businesses that are maybe making 5% bottom line, should be making 25%.
Oh, wow.
And then they come to you and ask you for advice, and I'd say, I'm not sure why you're asking me, because the last time I spoke to you and I gave you that advice and I put it in writing, you ignored it. And they sort of laugh it off. So this is where you look at the difference between a franchise business and probably businesses that you're advising to. You're there for one reason, to help them.
Yeah.
You're there to say, guys, look, here's what's going on. You need to confront this. Everybody needs to have a coach. When you're a student, you need a teacher. When you're a player playing sport, you need a coach. You run a business, well, who the hell's going to be making you answerable to your own disciplines and help you out? I see this not only in some of my own businesses, but also in others, where they get to a certain level or a certain stage and they sort of want to keep pushing back and pushing back. And I don't think they even know why they're doing it. They get to a stage where it's almost like, I want to fight and argue to prove my point, but my point is not worth proving. And you mentioned this before about when you see Gordon Ramsay. I specifically saw that episode where he went to a restaurant in Wangaratta in Victoria.
Yeah.
And it was heartbreaking to see how desperate they were to prove that this is the way we've always done it. And yet he came to him and said, but none of it's working, and they just look blank at him. So it's almost people that, like, it's almost they get into a zombie state.
Yeah, it's awful.
A misunderstanding of what they're trying to achieve. And what they're trying to achieve is a good lifestyle, a fantastically profitable business, and the ability to sell it eventually.
So I 100% agree. Our big mantra is a practice and a life that you love. And I think, you know, there's something in there for everyone. But coming to the sale point, again, we were talking off air about you're making sure that your business is sale ready as much as possible. And, you know, whether you choose to sell it or not is a different question. But let's talk about what it takes to have a business that is sale ready. You've exited. You sold Eagle Boys to private equity. And I'm curious to ask, you know, what did sale ready look like for you?
It took years for us to get sale ready. Mm-hmm. But before we got sale ready, we got a business that was very, very clearly defined on what its business plan and its strategy was.
Yeah.
And then once that business plan and strategy got into place, I brought in a advisory board to help me stay on track with that and then eventually an actual board of directors who were there specifically driven by an agenda to not necessarily do anything other than make sure we stuck to the business plan. If you were to rate our results in the first few years of a business plan, we were operating at about 60% achievement.
Okay.
And I think we got up to about 85 to 90, which is a great result. And then, of course, you're at a stage where if your business plan's working, your profit is there. If your profit's there, you're sale ready.
Mm.
No doubt about it. And in the last few years that I had Eagle Boys, my chairman clearly said to me, you need to cut back to about 2 days a week of just doing Eagle Boys stuff, bring in a GM and make sure that they don't need you when you do walk out the door.
Yep.
And that's what we did. And I like to challenge people sometimes when I do discussions with small business. I say to them, look, it doesn't matter whether your business has got 3, 4, 5 employees. Consider that tomorrow you were given a 12-month ticket, and that 12-month ticket says you've got 12 months to live. What are you going to do to structure that business to be ready for when you step out and your family has to take it over or have it managed after you're gone? Confronting, but it happens every day.
Yeah, sure does. So why is it that so many small businesses never get sale ready? What is it that stops them? Is it a lack of an awareness or is it a lack of urgency? Or what's your perspective on that?
I think it's two areas. One of them is they're too busy doing shit.
Yep. Day-to-day stuff.
Day-to-day stuff, you know, doing stuff that doesn't matter. I've had a discussion recently with one of my partners and I'm saying to him, we need to sit down and have another discussion about strategy.
Mm.
And he's too busy running around doing fucking shopping in supermarkets, buying, you know, cheap product for some of the store. And I'm sitting back going, it doesn't matter.
Really?
I mean,
And he's the business owner, is he?
Yeah. And I'm sort of saying, that shit doesn't matter.
No, it absolutely doesn't.
Deep down, he probably knows that, but it's a habit. He's got into this habit of doing things where they think, if I'm working hard, I must be doing well or I must be going to do well. And the answer is, you're not. So I think that the first problem is they're too busy doing it and not thinking about it. And the second part of it is a lot of them don't have the skills to actually sit down and go, what do I really need to focus on in this business? And that's where a third party, a consultant, an advisor is perfect. You know, I remember being in Canberra, was down there in Canberra on some AFL business at the time, and I remember Julia Gillard standing up and making a speech saying, we're moving forward. And I felt like yelling out at the back of my lungs, in the wrong fucking direction.
Yeah.
In the wrong direction.
Yeah, well.
So it's all good and well saying, I'm going to run down that road. I go, well, that might not be the right road. Just be careful because everyone else running down it doesn't mean it's right.
Yep. You just become a lemming. That's really interesting because I think I work exclusively in the dental industry, and you've had a lot of, I suppose, broader business experience than I have. You know, you've looked at different industries, and though you're known in the food industry, how do you avoid groupthink? I guess this is just something that I kind of am always making sure that I'm challenging the orthodoxy and trying to think of things that are different. It's just our whole business is based on the notion of not invented here. You know, I always look at other industries. So I'm curious, how do you avoid kind of getting caught up with the lemmings? How do you avoid running down the wrong road just because everyone else is?
It's a really good question. I actually think you have to test your strategy, and that strategy can come from external sources who have experience.
Yep.
And research. Now, I've noticed that research is an interesting one because I see some ads on television sometimes and I go, how the hell did that get approved? How the hell did an advertising agency turn up with that shit sandwich,
yep,
tell it to a management team who would call themselves marketing guys and then be able to go back to the CEO and go, this is what we're going to do?
Yeah.
It goes beyond me. And what it actually boils down to is the marketing brief is usually wrong in the first place.
Yes.
And the marketing brief can be easily corrupted by personal opinion. So in a lot of cases, you really have to ask the question, what is it you want to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
If they answer the question, we'll say, okay, if that answer is right, and let's say they say, I want to increase my sales 5% and I want to achieve a bottom line of 20% and I want to have an increase in customer retention, and those are all realistic numbers. You know, those are realistic things. You go, right, every time we make a decision, it has to be based on those three things. and just keep coming back to it. I was on the board of a certain company a few years ago. The matriarch and chairman made it very, very clear that the direction for the board was to be based on what was good for that particular family. And I said, okay, good, I'm clear on that. And then he would turn up at board meetings and put these harebrained ideas and concepts in front, and I'd say, look, I'm just following your lead here, but is this good for the family? And he'd go, yeah, and I'd say, explain that to me, and he couldn't.
Yeah.
Because he would say one thing and do another.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I think there's actually a lot of people that do that, Tom. I think that the whole idea of having a strategy sounds great, but then again, like the operations manual, kind of gets shelved and doesn't see the light of day again, and you just kind of continue on. So I want to ask you about organizational discipline, because that requires a certain discipline to operate in that lane and to stick in that lane. How did you achieve that so well? What was your ability like to do that? And obviously you did it well, but what helped you in that department?
Well, I didn't do it well. I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I would see opportunities that no one else saw, and then I would go hard at them. For example, building a restaurant in Fiji and things like that. And you found later that that was, you know, a disaster, a very quick disaster. And that's the entrepreneurial spirit that some of us have.
Yeah, I'm just laughing because I've got a couple of those stories of my own.
Yeah, that was the quickest 600 grand I ever lost. The question you're putting to me is, how did you stay on track along the way? Well, after making a few mistakes, you do have people around you who are honestly there for your discipline and for your best outcome, and they will clearly say to you, you need to go away and think longer and harder, and maybe even produce a full strategic paper on why we should be going down this road. But they wouldn't say no. They'd say, can you just go away and give this a little bit more strategic thought, because they knew how to handle me.
Yeah.
It was always like, this is a great idea, and they'd go, okay, why? Why?
In my organisation, I come up with an idea every 5 minutes. 99% of them are rubbish, but every now and then there's a good one. But my poor, long-suffering 2IC, he's a really good guy. He's very detail-oriented, and he's the guy that is, we call him the guardrails, right? Because he just stops us doing dumb shit. And so every time I come up with an idea, it's almost like I can see the colour drain from his face. And I have to now I have to preface my conversations by saying this is a provisional idea, just so that he can listen to the idea without kind of getting too bent out of shape about, you know, the harebrained idea that Jesse's going to roll with next.
And the good thing is, he can't live without you and you can't live without him.
No, 100%.
And as long as there's a continued mutual respect, you'll be fine.
Yeah, 100%. And it's like what one person brings, the other one doesn't have, and vice versa. And I think it's a good synergy. So, Tom, I want to ask you, just as we start to round out the conversation, obviously Eagle Boys, you know, is one of Australia's great success stories from a business point of view. Why did you sell it?
I'd got to a stage where the business, I'd had it for 20 years, and it needed a transition of capital.
Yep.
And it needed to probably go to the next level, being either owned by private equity with me or taking it straight into being a public company. We discussed all those points. The chairman rightly said, I don't think you're the right person to run a public company. And there's argument on both sides of that. But the possibility of me working with a venture capital group would have only led to the business being publicly listed anyway, or unsold. So when we went down that road, we also believed that, well, if you get into bed with the VCs now, you're going to end up becoming a public company anyway. So maybe it's time to just sell the business. And John said to me, he said, too many people don't get out at the right time. They don't get out when they're on top. And he also said, how much is enough?
Yeah.
And we talked about how the business had transitioned and evolved three times at least. The entire model had changed, you know, going from inline stores to building drive-throughs to inventing the two-minute pizza to rolling out in all the airports and sports stadiums and mobile pizza kitchens. It was a very creative business all across New Zealand. You know, John said to me, he said, I think you put your life on hold as well for a lot of things. Now, that was a mistake that I made. But he said, maybe it's time to get out. And eventually I sat there and I thought, he's right. How much is enough? Maybe I get out and take some time out. And that was the reason I sold. What happened in the next 10 years was heartbreaking, but that's another story.
Yeah, okay. So any regrets about selling, knowing now what has transpired post-sale?
Yeah, I regret who I sold it to, because I think that people make a lot of negative remarks about venture capital, and they're not always true. I think there's some really good venture capital businesses out there that really understand the values of what they're trying to achieve and the businesses that are around them. He's probably the first ever venture capitalist in Australia, wrote a couple of books, and I read them and I thought they were terrific. And he focused on the fact that why would venture capital come into a business and get rid of the founder who was the guy that got them there?
Yeah.
And why would you put money into a business without bringing the best possible skilled people on the board to help drive that business? Bill Ferris is who I'm talking about.
Okay.
He's written two or three books, and he is highlighted as Australia's first venture capitalist, and he's still in the game now, and they're big players. I regret who I sold it to, even though we thought, oh, they're Queensland-based, they manage Queensland funds. You know, of course, everyone had the same comment. Why would they go and stuff the whole thing up? There's no reason why they would, but, you know, there's a great story about the frog and the centipede trying to cross the river.
Tom, you've been really generous with your time today, and the story is fascinating and really interesting. If you had any particular advice you'd leave our audience with as we wrap up, what would be the key things, key messages you'd say to a small business owner, but indeed a dental practice owner who's, you know, looking to create that practice and a life that they love? You've touched on a few key concepts already, you know, how much is enough, having a saleable business, having your systems and processes and management structures in place. What would be the highlight reel or things to consider for people as takeaways?
Get off the tools.
Yep.
Because any idiot can do that. And step back and work on the business, even if it takes you the first year to say, I'm not going to be working on the tools 50 hours a week and I'll cut back to 20, you've achieved an enormous result in the first year. You know, it's the same old theory of the E-myth, you know, work on the business, not on it. Set yourself some goals. Make sure you're answerable to those goals. Make sure they're the right goals. A lot of us don't accept or don't remember is you got to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are getting into their businesses and they think, I'll be happy when I sell it. I'll be happy when I'm out of debt. I'll be happy when this happens. I'll be happy when that happens. And then they're never really happy.
Mm.
As opposed to, like, look, I haven't achieved this and I haven't achieved that, but let's have a look at what I have achieved.
Yeah.
Let's actually be more complementary to ourselves and what we have been able to get, as opposed to what we haven't, because you're never going to achieve everything. I was just looking at that bloody documentary on the Murdochs last night.
Oh, I watched that too. Yeah.
I saw it. You know, James Packer, he's struggling. You know, he's struggling with a lot of things. And you sit back and you go, you know, no money in the world's actually getting him probably where he wants to be. So, you know, it's just a matter of, I think you're making some choices about being happy in where you're at in your life. I mean, I don't live in a multi-million-dollar mansion and drive Rolls Royces or anything else, but I'm very happy in the lifestyle that I have. We have a handful of small businesses. We travel. We go wherever we want and play golf every Friday. I'm very happy with that.
Yeah.
I'm pissed off that it's October next month and the football season's over.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully it'll be a Lions Hawthorn Green final.
Well, hopefully. I'm pissed off that the Broncos have had a terrible season, but that's a whole other story.
You've had a shocker, mate.
Yeah. They really have. But anyway.
Cowboys are still in it, though.
Can't go the Cowboys. Anyway, Tom, again, mate, you've been really generous. So I just want to say, firstly, thank you so much for your time today, but for sharing your wisdom and your experiences and your insights is really valuable for the listeners and for me personally. I'm just really grateful. So from all of us here, mate, just want to express our heartfelt thanks. Hope we can do it again soon.
My absolute pleasure, Jesse. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.